This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Sunday marks the one-year anniversary of the false missile alert. So what's changed? Well, joining us today are Tom Travis, head of the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency, Hiro Toya, acting director of the city's Department of Emergency Management, Dolph Diamant, who is with FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here this morning.
Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
You know, before we get started and jump into our conversation, let's take a listen, refresh our memories, and listen to some of the folks who called in following that missile alert.
My name is Rachel, and I'm calling from Honolulu. During the false alarm for the ballistic missile, I made a makeshift bomb shelter in my restroom and waited there to die. I had food and water and a limited amount of supplies. And after I stockpiled all of that, I called everybody that I cared about or texted everybody that I cared about and wished them goodbye and had a couple of minutes of reflection in which I didn't have very many regrets, but I was very angry about the needlessness of nuclear war in general and then our current president's reckless, childish behavior. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Bill, and I'm calling from Nanoli. I was listening to public radio like I do every morning when a nuke thing came on my phone, and I figured it wasn't on public radio, just a scam. Shortly after, my grandson, nearly 14 years, texted me, nuke, with a bunch of exclamation points. So I immediately text back, duck, with a bunch of exclamation points. 20 minutes later or so, he texts back, LOL, which means lots of love, lots of laugh, or laugh out loud. It was a good memory. Have a good day. Thank you.
Hi, this is Carol. I'm from Kailua. I woke up and received texts from my daughters, and they said, I love you, Mama. If I'm dead, I love you, heart, 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 heart. Then I got a text saying, never mind. And that was how I knew something had happened, even though I had slept through it. So I haven't been re-experiencing the panic that others have, but I have a lot of guilt that I didn't go through it with my girls.
Hi, my name is John, and I'm calling from Nu'uanu. On Saturday morning, hearing the news, my first response was to sit down and email all of my siblings and children on the mainland, telling them that I love them, and hoping that the future of the human race and the future world would be one in which love and family were the foremost priorities. Having worked for 4 years at a former atomic weapons proving ground, I have firsthand experience and awareness of the effects of both fission and fusion weapons. My immediate response after sending that email out was to sequester myself in the only room in my house that has no windows and wait for a large white flash. Needless to say, I was quite relieved when that didn't happen.
Hi, this is Paul. I'm calling from the Big Island. I work with disabled American veterans, and a lot of my veteran comrades suffering from PTSD and anxiety disorder called me. I had about 15 call me, thinking it was the end of the world, and I had to go out and see some of them to try and calm them down after the all clear.
So those were some of the voices recalling what happened a year ago. And, you know, can we start out, Tom? Tell our listeners, you know, what's changed? What have we done to improve the system that was in place that day?
Yes. The first thing was that immediate actions were taken to ensure there would be no more missile alarms. Following that, short-term actions were held to ensure that the processes that had caused the problem were fixed or disabled, and that the people who had been involved in the mistakes were held accountable, and that urgent organizational changes were made. As you probably know, I wasn't there for either the false missile alert. So, I, of course, I understand it because I, as part of assuming my duties I've taken the mantle to be sure that it stays fixed. But the public needs to understand that we no longer have a program to do missile alerts. That program has been shelved. Both the danger of a missile alert has diminished, and reevaluation of the need for it has been done. We do have a way that we can warn the public if something. There are literally hundreds of things that could happen that we can't anticipate or plan for. And that is that we would sound the sirens and pass word on the media of what was happening. But there's no specific program anymore for the missile alert.
So we aren't doing those drills anymore?
No. Also, it should be understand if we develop, if something comes up in the future where we have to address a problem like this, we're going to take an approach in which we evaluate all of the risks and balance and develop an even program that addresses each of the risks. Sounding an alarm in itself is a risk, as we've seen with what happened on 13 January. That risk has to be sounded with the good it would do and the message we were putting out. It has to be integrated with the follow-on actions that would be needed by emergency responders so that they could give a coordinated response. And all those things have to be developed in parallel in a thoughtful way so that they contribute to each other and that we address each of them.
What can you tell us about the software? Because I know there was no false alarm drop down in the menu, I guess. What can you tell us about the software that's in place now?
Well, we're still using the same software, although it's been updated. But the way we use it is a little bit different, and we've developed additional capabilities. Although we've shelved the missile warning program, that doesn't mean that we aren't capable of sending out a false alarm for something else. And as a consequence, we've incorporated those messages necessary. So if we do send out a false alarm, we can be very timely in saying, hey, all clear, this isn't a problem, or all clear, this was a false alarm. So the all clear has been incorporated into the software use cases so that delay does not occur anymore.
Okay, so it says all clear versus this was a false alarm?
Could say either one, depending on
what it was.
Could
say either one.
Yeah.
Okay. And what about the physical setup in the civil defense area? Because that was one of the issues that came up in the report is that it wasn't really ideal for dealing, you know, with disaster management. I mean, has anything changed in that regard?
We still have the same physical plant that we had a year ago. Most of us that have looked at that think that there's a growing need for a new facility for the state, but inside the constraints of the size of the bunker in Diamond Head, because of the constraints of the size, there's not too much we can do in improving the layout of what's happening. We always review it and change it as a continuing process of improvement, but there's only so much we can do. The state warning point where the alarm was sounded is still in the same location. The training for the people in that has changed and been updated to include things that we learned from this incident. The alarm systems that are available are much the same, with the exception that we clearly recognize now the need for the all clear or this was a false alarm.
Okay. And Hero,
message.
Chime in here. How did the city and county's emergency management agency interface with the state?
Well, thank you for having me on the show, and I appreciate you having started the show with the calls from last year. It certainly brings back memories for me personally as well. But the emergency management is it's what we call a whole community effort. So it takes all levels of government working together, along with the community, along with media, along with private sector and nonprofit organizations, everybody working together. And so we at the City and County of Honolulu continue to work with the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency and all of our partners to improve our plans and response. But going back to January 13th last year, we were able to fairly quickly verify with Hawaii Emergency Management Agency that this was indeed a false alarm. And the Honolulu Police Department did actually go out and proactively notify the public who they could via their public address systems to say that it was a false alarm. But certainly the incident made us take a really hard look at our own plans. And what we did, and Tom sort of alluded to this as well, is look at it from an all-hazards perspective, meaning that what are the things that are common to emergency management, emergency response, regardless of what the event is. So whether it's a ballistic missile or a tsunami, there are certain common elements that we need to have in place. And so one of those key things is communications. You know, that always comes up as an issue. And so we realized at the city that we also need to improve our internal communication so that we can quickly get in touch with all the key leaders, not just within emergency management, but also some of the other key departments, our environmental services, for instance, facility maintenance, and of course, our leadership at the city and county, Mayor Caldwell and his administration. How can we quickly get in touch with them and communicate with them? And so we made some internal enhancements to notification systems that we had so that we can quickly do that with a couple clicks of a mouse. And we have that capability 24 hours a day. So we have the Honolulu Police Department functioning as the Oahu warning point. And that means, of course, they're 911 24/7 response, but they're also serving as this warning point in which they're in 24/7 contact with Haima's state warning point so that anytime an event's occurring, we can get quickly notified and start the notifications from there. So that's one aspect is the internal communications. And of course, we realized that we had some gaps in terms of our public communication capabilities as well. So anytime something is happening, we want to be able to quickly notify the public, redundant means of communication. So it does include systems that the Haima uses that Tom mentioned for sending the alerts. But we also have our smartphone application called HNL.info that was developed by our Department of Information Technology in-house. And one of the gaps we found is that this application, people sign up for different topics that they want to receive messages for. So one category is weather and disaster. So you would get messages about flood warnings, about incoming hurricanes or other events. Another category is road closures. So if there's a major road closures, we would notify the public through this application. But if you weren't subscribed to the right category, then you wouldn't receive the notification that we send. So we actually made an enhancement to the system so that we can send a notification to all subscribers regardless of what topic they were subscribed to. So I think communication internally and with the public, those are some of the key areas that we looked at in terms of our review after January 13th.
I know we did talk to the head of the handy van. And she was talking about the changes that they made because, you know, the drivers had passengers on board and, you know, they had no way to figure out what was going on. And the passengers were telling the drivers, oh, my gosh, we just got this alert. So they developed a whole system to be able to communicate, you know, internally as well. So good things happened. You know, we found out where our vulnerabilities are and what we need to do to fix those things. And Dolph, as we come around the table, we thought you were gone because you're originally, I think, from Seattle. You're based in Seattle, and you've been here because we've had disaster upon disaster happen, and you've been here to help kind of with the recovery effort.
It's kind of hard to believe, Catherine. I mean, I came back on May 9th as a result of the April floods in Kauai and Honolulu, area, and I've been here ever since, actually. There was a series of back-to-back disasters. Nobody could see that coming, actually. I thought it was going to be – I was lucky to get a disaster in Hawaii that seemed manageable, and then we got hit by five major disaster declarations. Some were emergency declarations, but the we're still in the recovery mode here. It takes a long time to recover from all of those serious disasters. These were big disasters that Hawaii experienced. So, yeah, I've been here quite a while, and I've had a team in place. It's much smaller now, but we still have a lot of work ahead of us.
And when do you think you'll be able to go back home to Seattle?
Well, the plan is, for me personally, to close down the Joint Field Office on the 28th of February, and that will turn into a long-term recovery office with a state and county integration for months and probably years. It sometimes takes – long-term recovery can take decades. And we have major challenges over on the Big Island, and we're going to stay focused on this. There's been an appointment of federal disaster recovery coordinator and a state disaster recovery coordinator, which is the first time in Hawaii history that we've gone down that route, but it's basically the first time that we've needed the long-term recovery effort.
And Tom, do you think because we had this experience with the missile alert that we were maybe more on our toes with all these natural disasters that happened?
Well, I think it started a pattern that lasted until September that essentially kept the organization in response mode.
Right, they were testing you. Right?
Yes, most of us feel fairly experienced at this point.
Yeah,
well, at responding to disasters.
If there's a bright side to being in response for 6 months, it's that you build those relationships, and with HERO, we know the county people, we all know each other, and we've built relationships. We have lessons learned each time that we can apply to improve the next response. That's done a lot of good, and we're continuing to analyze what we did and how we can do it better next time.
I would like to add to that yeah. It's very important. The way the world works is when something happens, you learn a lesson, and then you slowly forget it, and it goes back to normal. It's very important that we learn as much and codify as much in our response from what we've learned this year as possible. This has been a trying time, but it's also a great opportunity. We've developed procedures and processes and relationships that work, and we need to be sure to keep those in place. And that's one of my highest priorities.
That's a good point, because the faces will change around this table. And certainly you folks weren't in place that day. I think Vern Miyagi, I was hearing from out in the field, that he was out volunteering when the lava hit the Big Island. So he was still continuing his capacity to try and help the community.
Well, as a volunteer.
Right.
As a volunteer, we became essentially the manning and the resources manning, the personnel assignments. And the resources assigned to Hawaii Emergency Management Agency were not sufficient in themselves for this long-term response. And so we had to reach out both to other departments and agencies in the state government as well as to volunteers in the community. And, just one of the stories is that Vern served as the state coordinating officer working with Dolph for the Kauai and Oahu flooding incident, so that I could focus on the Big Island, was happening
mm-hmm.
on the lava. And so we had responses from different agencies. We had volunteers that were all FEMA people, all of which went around and helped us do our job as we moved around. That's one of the big lessons learned, is that we have to build a very large reserve capacity to deal with disasters that may occur in the future.
We do have a couple of calls on the line. Alan from Honolulu.
Yep.
Are you there?
Hi.
You have a question? What's on your mind?
I do have a question. You know, one thing I noticed when I was on my deck, St. Louis Heights, looking out, thinking, oh, am I going to see something happen? I also had my TV on, looking for the media to response, and there was no response. It was a little frustrating. And I was wondering, I don't know that you have any media with you today interviewing, but it doesn't sound like, is the media going to change the way they interact with these issues that might pop up?
Good question, Alan. I know we did address this, I think, as broadcasters. You know, what were the procedures that were followed, and what could we improve on? And I don't know if there's anything you can add on this, Tom, because there have been meetings, I think, with all the broadcasters about this very issue.
There certainly is something that I can add to that, and that's that each state is required to have a plan, which they develop with the broadcasting community, to deal with disasters as they come up. One of the lessons learned from the false missile alert was that plan had not been updated since 2000. I think it was 2005. I might have the date wrong, but it was decades ago. And it was far enough back in the future that things like Twitter and Facebook and, you know, those weren't common terms and common places where people went for information. The entire way broadcasting systems, radio stations in particular, work has changed in those decades. And so we've been working hard to update that plan, and hopefully we're nearing completion of having an update of that plan. That plan is updated by broadcasters working with emergency management personnel. And so, yes, we're working on that so that relationship is stronger. And there are a lot of challenges to meet because of the way media has changed in those decades.
Okay, well, if you're just joining us, this is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. We're talking about the anniversary of the false missile alert. You can join the discussion by calling 1-877-941-3689. Stay with us. We'll be right back after a break.
The British Parliament votes on Theresa May's Brexit deal next week. The debate has gotten ugly, but there are some economic realities here.
Because it's not just the United Kingdom that needs the EU as a trading partner, but the EU needs the United Kingdom too.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Brexit deal or no deal, trade will go on. That is next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6.
This is public radio, but we wanted to give you the flavor of these literary events. The best of Aloha Shots is going on the road. Maybe some of you guys never heard of Aloha Shots, but Garen's, this show is the real thing. Get poems and stories by local writers, read by actors, and that wahine with the sexy voice, Noi Tanigawa, hosting the whole shebang. Plus, choke live music. Check them out at hprtickets.org.
Sponsored in part by Kamuela Farmers Market.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Wealth Jar and Locations.
We are back with The Conversation. We do have another call on the line, Nandita from Kaneohe. You had a point to make about the media's role with the alert.
Yeah, I'm calling because one of my largest frustrations with the false missile alert was the fact that not only did the state not tell us that it was a false missile alert for so long, but neither did the media. As soon as I got the alert, I turned on HPR thinking, obviously they must have the alert as well, and they'll tell me something. And there was nothing. There was just kind of like pre-recorded shows. There was no interruption of those shows to tell us what was going on. And I just couldn't believe it. It was, as far as I'm concerned, not only a big fail from the government, but a big media fail as well.
Very good point. I know when I was out on the beach and I heard the alert, I called into the TV station's newsroom where I had worked for many years, and I said, "Hey, what's going on? You know, what's the latest?" And they said, "We can't get a hold of anybody at the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency." And so, yeah, there was this big disconnect. They couldn't get a hold of your folks, Tom, and so they couldn't get the word out because they needed verification.
That is exactly right, and that is one of the other lessons learned from this that applies not only to false missile alert but to communication with the press. Our procedures did not emphasize the importance of getting our public information officer involved in the response, and as a consequence, he wasn't called for some time. So the people that the press, the person the press is used to talking to, and the people that we used to talk to the press was not involved in the process for many minutes.
And we do want to take a step back and go to our talkback line, where a number of folks have called in this past week just to talk about what they remembered that day a year ago.
Aloha, this is Lorraine from the island of Maui. Last year during the missile crisis, a group of us were flying over to Oahu from Maui for a business event. We had just flown over the military bases and all was quiet. When we had landed, our cell phones started pinging. There was no directive or anybody in the airport had any idea of where to go or what to do. So we knew that there was no activity in the military bases, so that something must have been wrong. But I called my sister and told her I loved her anyways and asked if she had heard anything on the mainland. There's not much else you can do but call your loved ones and tell them that you love them and wait. Aloha.
My name is Mark. I live at Sunset Beach, North Shore, Oahu. And in my Air Force days, I was a part of the Minuteman nuclear missile program, so I have specific training with a Dodge 10 and a Continental Ballistic Missile. So when I was at home and I got the text message alert and also had the TV alert, I wasn't panicked. My wife headed to the bathroom, but I felt a sense of dread knowing that the North Koreans had not developed a targeted reentry system. And this sounds kind of morbid, but I kind of wish they had, because that meant he could have actually targeted the vehicle, which would have taken out either Honolulu or Pearl Harbor or both, and we probably would have survived the initial blast on the North Shore. However, understanding and knowing that he did not have a targeted reentry vehicle, that he would just be lobbing the missile our way, which in theory, if he had done that, could have literally hit offshore the North Shore or hit the North Shore or whatever. So my sense of dread and worry for a few minutes was over the fact that he actually did not have the technology in place to guide the missile to a specific target.
The effect on me from the false missile alert was to fully realize the benefits of meditation. Because of the many years I've been practicing calm abiding, my reaction was one of curiosity. I was wondering if, hey, is this going to be how I end? It was really powerful, and it was an excellent reminder, to quote Henry James, that it's really important to live all you can, because it's a mistake not to.
My name is Rex. I'm from Hanapepe. I'm the interim minister of a congregation here. I was in Hawaii last January when the false missile alarm came on my cell phone. Having grown up near Omaha, Nebraska, and off at Air Force Base, Strategic Air Command, back in the Cold War days, I saw the note. I had brewed a cup of good Kauai coffee and decided I'd have it. There was nothing I could do about this, and was relieved when I finished my coffee that a notice had come. That message was a false one. Hope that they've been able to get everything cleared up since then. Bye.
So there you go. Some voices remembering what they were going through that day. And I don't know, where were you folks that day? Do you remember what you were thinking when you got that alert on your phone?
Yeah, so I was at home when I got the alarm, and this is something that we had been discussing with the state as far as the ballistic potential for a ballistic missile threat. And, of course, I looked at the phone, and I think I felt the same way as a lot of other folks out in the public.
We seem to be having some technical difficulties here, and hopefully we can get that worked on. And Tom, where were you? I mean, do you recall what was going on?
Yeah, it was. I was in Tucson, Arizona, and I got a call from one of my friends on the Big Island, and he said, "Guess what I just saw on the phone." I had never used Twitter before, but I'd been told by people that Twitter is a wonderful tool to understand breaking news. And so I immediately went on Twitter and started following what was happening. And I followed it on Twitter and talked to my friend on the Big Island for about the 40 or 50 minutes that it took.
I know the governor took some heat because he couldn't remember his Twitter password, I think, at the time. And what about you, Dolph? Where were you?
I was over on the East Coast working Hurricane Irma in Florida. And I think a good point is that, you know, as much as it was impacting Hawaii, this kind of information spread around the world instantly. So everybody was aware of that and concerned if you had any loved ones in Hawaii trying to communicate. So the communication was not just internal to Hawaii. It was across the United States, probably across the whole world. Huge, huge impact, I think, because of social media.
Right. So it was a wake-up call, really, to the whole country, thinking, whoa, what just happened here? Right? Yeah. And I know that there was a lot of concern. Some folks, you know, very emotional, as we heard from the talkback line. And I know there were threats of a lawsuit, I think, from the button pusher, the so-called button pusher. And I don't know if you can really talk about that, Tom. I don't think that there was ever a lawsuit filed, but he no longer works at the agency.
No, he doesn't work at the agency, and I can't comment on any of the lawsuits involved.
Okay, well, I did talk to the attorney, and he said, no, they did not file a defamation lawsuit, but that there'd been some something worked out where I think he may have gotten some benefits from the state, but that's all I know. There were some other lawsuits. I think folks who really thought this was the end, and I don't know the status of those cases, but, you know, today we're hearing a lot about the government shutdown, and, you know, we talk about the disasters. And so, you know, Dolph, I have to ask, I mean, people are probably wondering, you know, if something were to happen, how are we today? Are we going to be prepared?
Well, I guess the first thing I like to say is that FEMA work in Hawaii has been largely unaffected by the shutdown. That is a good thing. The way we're set up with the disaster, all our funding comes from a disaster relief fund, and then that doesn't get affected by a lapse in appropriations or anything. So the money's there, and staff like myself are considered essential personnel, and we get paid out of that disaster relief fund. So that kind of work continues, but our biggest fear is, and we talk about this on our conference calls right now, for the people that are not furloughed, is another sudden large event that needed to be responded to would cause us to have to close down all these operations. It has an impact. Believe me, we're not as ready because the Homeland Security is a big organization. A lot of that is a lot of those people are furloughed right now, and they also participate in our FEMA responses. So that's a huge concern right now. So the faster that gets over with, the better.
And I know there's discussion about the border wall and whether funds could be diverted from disaster response to build that wall.
Yeah, I think that's a bad move. If you're taking away from recovery operations or response, you're talking about people's lives. And that's what Congress enacted that whole Stafford Act for, was to ensure that we have funding for life safety and those type of things. And recovering is so important because there's more disasters down the road. You have to be ready for those. So anyway, that's my thoughts on that.
We do a lot of preparation for these disasters, and I know we've watched all these different events this past year happen in California, and other places, you know, with the various hurricanes. Any message that you want to underscore to the public out there just about, you know, we stress preparedness, but you can't predict everything, right?
I'll make a quick comment, if I may. It's one of the things that I think is important. There was recently an article in Los Angeles Times about the fire in Paradise in which dozens of people were killed due to a wildfire, Paradise, California. If we would have gone into Paradise before the fire occurred, most of the people in Paradise thought that they were the second best prepared city in California behind San Diego. And they felt very good at what they had done drills, they had done practice evacuations, they had done many, many things. The problem was that they had always exercised against a scenario in which their response would be successful. And they had not looked at the possibility that the fire could be an ember spread fire, which is a fire that's spread by embers far out in front of the front of the flames.
Right, because of winds.
Because, yes, and it's a consequence of high winds. An ember spread fire goes much, much faster. I have a picture of a snake on a rock that's trying to figure out what's going on, that's just been fried into place from a fire moving many, 60, 70 miles an hour.
You don't have time to respond.
Right. And so Paradise was not prepared for that fire. And I look at Hurricane Lane and look at the seriousness of what could have happened if Hurricane Lane would have hit us as even a Cat 2, Cat 3, Cat 4 hurricane, which it was just hours before. And that is something that I think we need to continue to work at, both in the community and the government, to prepare for. I don't want to have the lesson that, hey, we looked at the worst case and we didn't look at the worst case, and we now know Hurricane Lane type storms are possible, and we have to seriously take a turn to prepare for them.
Can I make one point on preparedness? Another one that we, and I know Hero emphasizes that a lot, is the personal preparedness. We're talking about a whole community. But to create an emergency plan for your family and make sure everyone in the family knows how to react to different disasters, you know, including hurricanes, floods, fires, power outages, you know, actually know, you'll feel better knowing you're prepared to think through these things. And that will serve for all sorts of disasters, you know, and that's a big message to get out, is take the time now while we're in between disasters to use this time to prepare for the inevitable next disaster. So emergency plan, and also check your insurance. Make sure you're insured for disasters. And those maybe Hero wants to.
Yeah, absolutely. Those personal preparedness items are really important. I just want to go back real quick to what Tom was saying about the hazards that we're preparing for. And absolutely, we need to continue to evaluate our hazards and how those can impact us. And one example of that is after the Tohoku earthquake and tsunami that happened in Japan, there was some reevaluation of our tsunami evacuation zones, and some of our scientists that work with us and also at UH identified some additional threats for tsunamis that could come from elsewhere at a higher level. So that, as a result of that, we came up with the extreme tsunami evacuation zone. And so now we have two tsunami evacuation zones. We have the regular tsunami evacuation and the extreme tsunami evacuation zone. So we want to make sure that we're continuing to evaluate the hazards that we have and preparing for them accordingly. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, going back to Dolph's point, we have so many different functions that has to get performed during an emergency. And we have amazing first responders here in Hawaii. We have some of the best in the world. But they can't be everywhere all at once, and they can't be everything to everybody. And, you know, our capacity to respond to these large-scale events could potentially be limited And so we got to be doing what we can to reduce our hazards. So that includes individual preparedness, everybody having a plan for themselves and their families, having supplies, having a way to get information, access credible sources of information. I think that was a recurring theme from January 13th. And if you can prepare yourself, then also take a look at how we can help your community. We actually had some volunteer groups that activated after the April floods on Oahu, went out, did some cleanup of homes, thinking of a couple of groups, Aina Haina Prepared, led by Mr. Danny Tengon, a former state civil defense employee, and also Mr. Matt Glay from Hawaii Kai Strong. They're volunteers. They went out and helped their community members clean up. In fact, they actually also helped us do damage assessments so we can submit that information to FEMA to get that disaster declaration. And so if you can prepare yourselves and your help prepare your community, it could be a real asset. In addition to that, of course, government does have a role in trying to reduce the long-term risks of disasters. So currently we're in the process of updating our hazard mitigation plan. So what are these things that we can do collectively to try to reduce the risk of future disasters?
I think also the point that we've got with climate change, where things are happening that didn't happen before. You know, who would have thought you'd see waves on Kalani-Aneoli Highway, you know, with rain bombs, you know, coming from, you know, the mountains. We all thought maybe, you know, there'd be tidal waves coming from the ocean side. And so that was completely crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. We have some of the longer term impacts, you know, sea level rise. But we are also already seeing some of the impacts of climate change already, increased frequency of storms and other events. And so, again, we need to continually evaluate the hazards that are going to impact us and prepare for those at the right level.
And we do have a number of calls on the line. Chris from Honolulu, what's on your mind?
Yeah, this is Chris. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yeah, so I have just two quick plugs, a lead-in sentence and then my question. The first plug is for our guests. Just kudos to everyone who's dedicating their lives and their professions to this this great effort to try and keep us all prepared. The other plug, obviously, is for NPR and HPR, because you know, without you, we wouldn't have this great information. My lead-in sentence is, I'm a military provider, so I have learned through about 30 years of service that we learn the lessons of taking care of others at a very high cost, and then we forget them, and we constantly struggle against trying not to forget them. And so my question for the group is this. With the rise in big data, artificial intelligence, computer learning, and modeling, can't we implement some form of leveraging those strong tools to develop these plans using modeling, AI, things that folks much smarter than me have said are going to be the future, so that as those of us retire and retire with our knowledge, and folks coming behind us have to relearn them or pull them off a shelf and not know where to find them, couldn't that be more hardwired and use these great tools and platforms that are all in our hands for the benefit of all of us? That's hopefully as succinct as I can be.
All right. Thank you, Chris. Who wants to take that?
I'll just say sounds right, and we need to be moving forward on that, and I hope that we are already.
I think you're hitting on the future of emergency management, actually. Can't comment any more on that personally, but you're right on the money.
Hero?
Yeah, I agree. And I believe we have some demos coming up from some vendors that have some of these capabilities. So definitely, I think it's in the future for us, and we'll be looking into that.
Okay, and we have another call on the line, Linda from Waikele. You have a question? Oh, I guess we have a shy caller. Her point, I think, was that no one has really addressed the issue of sirens that went off on the military bases. I don't know, Tom, you want to chime in there? Because I know there was some discussion about coordination with the military, because I think it was at Pearl Harbor where there was some voice of God system that they've got that made some announcement.
What happened, as I recall my studies of what happened, was that as a result of the cell phone alert that was sent out by the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency, the operators of the sirens on the military bases, which are operated separately from state sirens, went ahead and sounded the sirens. The state sirens were never sounded. So the question here is, why did the military sirens sound? The head of, I think it's the base there that did that, in testimony at one of the hearings, effectively said that the sirens were sounded as a matter of watch officers taking initiative, thinking something was wrong and getting the public up and alert to it. And he defended the fact that they did that. And I think I would agree with him. It's unfortunate that it added to the concern, but I think it's appropriate, if we thought something bad was happening, that we do what we can to inform the public that they need to get up and get themselves moving and think about what's happening.
Yeah, right. And from my perspective, you know, we operate on trust, you know. So when Hawaii Emergency Management Agency tells us that something's happening, we take their word for it. And Tom's been working hard to rebuild that trust. And certainly he's joined us early in 2018 and has been quite busy with real-world response ever since then. And he's been doing everything he can to rebuild that trust with us. And so for something that's as short notice as, you know, the threat that we were talking about, there isn't really a whole lot of time for us to go back and forth. Is this real? Is this not real? You know, we have to be able to implement plans quickly. So, but at the same time, you know, there's got to be some checks in place to make sure that we're sending out the correct information. But really, the relationship building is so important for what we do, not only with the public but also with each other. And so I believe that we have a strong working relationship. And I think the Hawaii Emergency Management leadership, you know, Vern Miyagi, of course, resigned as a consequence of this event. But as noted earlier, he's a dedicated man. He stayed on, helped us. And I don't think the flood response on Oahu, I don't think we could have gotten the presidential declaration for individual assistance without him having been involved. That's and, of course, Dolph and his team. And, of course, from the governor's office, Fort Fuchigami was really closely involved with this whole thing. I mean, it took leadership from all these folks. And we just – I believe that we have some amazing people working here in the state of Hawaii to protect the public. And, of course, we have a lot of work to do in terms of actually implementing the lessons learned from this past year. But that's what gives me hope is the fact that we have such dedicated people working here with us.
And, you know, Tom, I know when I was on the beach and I heard that, I saw the alert, and then I immediately went to a nearby hotel, and they had used the alarms to get everybody's attention to let them know this was a false alert. But for a second there, it was disconcerting because, you know, it had those alarms that we're so used to hearing. So, you know, we had this gulp for a second. But what do you think about the use of that? Because, you know, obviously we saw that with the military, like you mentioned.
It's unfortunate that we notice these things when it's a false alert. But that sort of initiative is exactly what is needed from the community to be sure that we all get as ready as we can when something unexpected happens. You know, we don't have time in many parts of the state. If there's a local tsunami, we don't have time to sit down and verify whether there really is a danger or not. We need to act, and we need to act immediately. And so I would be very, very reluctant to criticize any of the hotels that took the initiative or the people that sounded the sirens on the military base. I think that is probably a good thing, not something that I would criticize.
Okay, and we've got like less than 2 minutes. Any final thoughts?
Well, I just wanted to comment, having been kind of an outsider here from FEMA, watching the state and county, that they are very, very dedicated, hardworking professionals, and it's very impressive to see them at work and what we've accomplished. Tom is focused for the state building capacity for future disasters, 100%. evaluating what happened last year and seeing how we can fix it. He's talking to me all the time about lessons learned, et cetera, and capturing those things. So that's all good. My bottom line is we hope for the best and plan for the worst.
Okay. All right. Toru, 30 seconds.
Well, as I alluded earlier, you know, emergency management is a whole community effort. And so we're going to continue to do what we need to do on the government end. But we also encourage the public to take action for themselves, make a plan, build a kit, and stay informed on what can affect you. And if you got your own house squared away, then consider volunteering for your community, for Red Cross, for Humane Society. There's a number of other organizations out there that do emergency management response. So please take some action now to prepare yourselves.
Be prepared. We'd like to thank our guests, Hiro Toya, the city's Department of Emergency Management Acting Director, Dolph Diamant, FEMA's Federal Coordinating Officer, and Tom Travis, head of the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency. And we'd like to thank you, the listener, for joining us on today's show. If your call didn't make it on the line, you can call the talkback line and leave your comments, 808-792-8217. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday for more of The Conversation.